The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB. Be sure and visit us online at sportstalk1240.com. And now, Sports Talk 1240.
All right, well, good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to hour number one of Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, Long Island, New York. Phil Donahue taking you through the first hour on this Sunday night, the 8th day of May, Mother's Day. Wishing all you moms out there a great Mother's Day. I hope it's been a wonderful day for you. Our engineer, Brian Graves, is across the way. We've got a great show lined up for you tonight. Andre Dawson will not be with us tonight. He called me this morning. We'll try to get him on May 22nd on that broadcast. Up first, we'll welcome in the three-time world champion third baseman of the Oakland A's, Sal Bando. In the second half, we'll talk to the former great closer for the Mets, Expos, Twins, amongst others, Jeff Reardon. So sit back, relax, enjoy Sports Talk 1240 tonight on GBB. Got some great stuff up ahead in the next few hours. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page titled Sports Talk 1240. There you'll find sports information, show information, and more. So stop by, give us a look, then you can click and give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter at Sports Talk 1240. And all past shows can be heard on our website at www.sportstalk1240.com. Well, my first guest was a member of one of the finest teams to ever take the diamond, the Oakland A's of the early 70s. He's a three-time world champion, a four-time All-Star. I welcome to the Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Sal Bando. Sal, good evening.
Good evening, Bill.
Great to have you with us, Sal. Now, you were born in the Cleveland, Ohio area, correct?
Correct, yes.
Who did you grow up rooting for? Any favorite teams, favorite players?
Well, the Cleveland Indians and Al Rosen and Rocky Colavito were the two that I really idolized. And you know, I was fortunate enough to get to know both gentlemen when I got into pro ball.
Wonderful. Yeah, certainly two great examples right there, Colavito and Al Rosen. Now, you played your college ball at Arizona State University, one of the great programs in the country, for Bobby Winkles. Talk to us a little bit about your days at ASU.
Well, in those days, I was there in 1962. It was my first year. Freshmen weren't eligible to play varsity. And then in 63, I was on the varsity, and Bobby Winkles was just a great coach. But the University of Arizona was the big wig in those days, and we were able to dethrone them and take over, and ASU's program just took off from there. And in 1965, my junior year, we won the College World Series, and from then on, I think Bobby Winkles won three national championships, 65, 67, and 69.
Yeah, he did. He went on to manage in the major leagues as well, Bobby Winkles, a great baseball man. The first two seasons with the A's in Kansas City, Sal, you played for Alvin Dark and Lucius Appling, the great Hall of Famer. How were those guys to play for?
Well, I was, kind of called up and down in those days.
Uh-huh.
I hadn't really established myself. Alvin Dark, you could tell right away, he just really had a great mind for baseball and for strategy and vision. Luke was kind of a fill-in. He was a great ball player, but I got to admit, on the managing side, he lacked a little bit.
Okay.
He was filling in because the ownership wanted him to take over.
Yeah, okay. And then Bob Kennedy took the reins in 68 when he came up full-time. Did they move Danny Cater over to first to make room for you, Sal?
I think he filled in at third because Ed Charles had left. So
Think
originally he was the first baseman. But the funny thing about Bob Kennedy, when I was in high school, a friend of mine signed with the Indians, and he recommended me to the Indians, and Bob Kennedy worked me out, and he told me after he didn't think I'd make it because my legs were too big, and sure enough, he and I become, manager and player in 1968.
Uh-oh, yeah. Good story there, Sal. Yeah, we're speaking of Sal Bando tonight on Sports Talk 1240. In 68, when you do come up full-time, like we said, the core of the great team, the great A's team, was taking shape with you at third, Campy Campanaris, Joe Rudy, Reggie Jackson, and Catfish Hunter, correct?
Correct.
Talk to us a little bit about those, the early days of the Oakland A's team.
Well, our first full year really all together coming up through the minor league system, we ended up finishing, I think, at 568, which really was important because by then we had moved most of the veteran ball players. So we had Reggie in right, Joe Rudy in left, myself at third, Campanaris, Dick Green at second. Mm-hmm. And then we ended up using a number of different guys at first base. And so Catfish was the main pitcher. We had Jim Nash. And so we slowly groomed them, bring up Lolly Fingers, who was a starter, then became a closer. So that was the foundation for our team.
It certainly was. Now, what some folks may not remember, Sal, is that the management of the A's brought in a guy by the name of Joe DiMaggio to be the hitting coach for the A's in those days. What stories do you have with Joe DiMaggio coming along as the coach?
Well, Joe was our hitting coach in 1968-1969.
Uh-huh.
What I found amazing, other than his baseball mind, I mean, he was just brilliant. But when we took commercial flights in those days, when we would walk through airports, people would just stop and point at him and say, "There goes the great Joe DiMaggio."
Wow.
I mean, it was amazing how many people just recognized him.
Yeah. What a great man he was. And as the hitting coach of the Oakland A's, I believe the reason they brought him in, Sal, was because he needed two more years to collect on his full pension. And the 68 and 69 got him those 2 years on the pension.
Well, I didn't realize that, but that was very nice of Charlie Finley to do it. Plus, you know, being from the Bay Area, it was a great move to
sure.
bring him to the Oakland side.
Definitely, yeah. Joe DiMaggio from San Francisco. Now, speaking of Charlie O'Finley, the great owner of the Oakland A's, give us a little insight on Charlie. I know a lot of times, and we'll talk about it in a little bit, that there were some feuds with the ball players, but he's known as one of the most flamboyant, eccentric, if you will, and definitely innovative owners in baseball history.
Well, he, you know, it was his idea to play the World Series at night,
mm-hmm.
The colorful uniforms, the white shoes. He had a lot of great ideas. He had some ideas that weren't too great, but like we had orange baseball,
yeah.
which nobody could throw because they were slippery. But, yeah, I think he brought a lot to the game. He was his own general manager. He would call other general managers and get their opinions. And in some ways, it was good having the owner be the general manager. There was nobody he had to check with.
Exactly, yeah. He had nobody to talk down to. We've got Sal Bando tonight with us on Sports Talk 1240. Now, that Oakland A's dynasty that won the series 72, 73, 74. Some great names, some Hall of Famers on that. We'll go through a couple of guys. First of all, what changed when Dick Williams took the reins?
Well, I think Dick's reputation preceded him. He was a no-nonsense guy. There was none of this whining and I should do this. And he took the reins and he said, "It's going to be this way and this is the way we're going to do it." And sure enough, it worked. And we had a great run with Dick. And he really helped mold us into a mature winning ball club.
He certainly did. And at shortstop, you had the great, the steady, the great base stealer, Bert Campanaris.
Well, Bert was such an underrated player because without him, we would not have been successful. He got on base, he stole bases, he drove in runs, he could hit the home run, he played an excellent shortstop. So he really, to me, was the key to our offense. And then we eventually added Billy North, another base stealer.
Right.
He was a good center fielder. And those two guys were hit one and two. It really set the table for us.
Definitely. You got to keep those guys off the base paths. Now, on the hill, you had an ace, the great Hall of Famer, Catfish Hunter.
Well, Catfish was the number one guy. So we had Vita Blue, Ken Holtzman,
mm-hmm.
And then we'd fill in from there with different guys. But the big three, for Hunter and Blue and Holtzman. And the funny thing is, when you have a number one, he goes against everyone else's number one. You win that game, your number two is better than most number twos, and your number three is a lot better. So that was a big advantage for us.
Definitely. Good way to look at it, Sal. I believe another guy who you may call underrated is a good RBI man, Joe Rudy.
Absolutely. Joe wasn't a flashy player. He was just a steady player. He played an excellent left field, made no mistakes out there, drove in runs, was a good hit for an average. He could do everything, but probably couldn't steal a base. But other than that, he was a perfect guy for our team.
Good man, Joe Rudy. Now, one guy, Sal, that's probably not underrated is the great number nine, Reggie Jackson.
Well, there's no question. He was the mainstay and the key guy to our lineup. He made our club go, and he hit number four for us. He brought excitement to the ballpark. He brought maturity in a lot of ways. And he had a swagger that we all kind of followed. And Reggie Jackson was the ace. He was the heart of the ace.
He certainly was. And we just spoke about him a little bit, Sal. The sensation that this guy caused in baseball when he came up and took the league by storm. Cover of Sports Illustrated, The Sporting News, Vita Blue.
Well, Vita, I really believe if he didn't hold out after his first year, he might have been the best pitcher ever, because his first year, nobody could hit him. I mean, he just threw the ball by people. The next year, he didn't have a spring training because he held out for his contract, and he was never the same. I mean, he still threw hard, but he didn't have the movement he did that first year. And I think if he would have gone to spring training and worked out his contract, he would have been unbelievable.
And here's another guy, another colorful ball player that the A's had, colorful nickname, no pun intended, John Blue Moon Odom.
Yeah, Johnny Blue Moon was one of the original bonus babies that Charlie Finley signed from Macon, Georgia. And he had so much movement on his fastball, he was hard to catch. And Johnny's another guy that I think he had it to do all over again. He would make some changes in his life. He would have been even greater than he was.
Certainly, certainly, definitely John Blue Moon Odom. Finally, out of the bullpen, one of the great relief pitchers of all time, a Hall of Famer, somebody who really set the scene for the relievers of today, Raleigh Fingers.
Well, we used to tell Raleigh he became a reliever because he couldn't get past the national anthem as a starter. So he was a starter, and in fact, the best game he ever had as a starter, he replaced Blue Moon Odom after one hitter and threw 8 2/3 shutout innings. That was his one and only good start.
Amazing.
After that, he became a closer.
Amazing, yeah. Raleigh Fingers, great, great man, great Hall of Famer. Well, take a look at a couple of the series, Sal. We got Sal Bando tonight on Sports Talk 1240, the great Oakland A's third baseman. 1972, A's versus Reds. It kind of turned out to be a matchup of the two dynasties of the 70s. The Reds won two series in four appearances. Of course, you guys with Oakland won three straight. Charlie Finley's guys, you had the Day-Glo uniforms, the facial hair, the colorful nicknames, the explosive personalities, and the Reds were more traditional. No facial hair, the high socks. The everyday lineup featured Hall of Famers, just like Oakland did. The series was dubbed, I believe, the Hairs versus the Squares. Now, with Reggie and Darryl Knowles out, Sal, it seemed like Oakland is the underdog in that series.
Well, in fact, we were the underdog all seven games.
Mm-hmm.
And because of Reggie and Darryl not being able to play. But we had good pitching. We had strong bullpen. And that kept us in the game. And Gene Tennis had the series of his life.
Right, Tennis.
To get the most valuable player. And he had some clutch hitting. And that's how we beat him.
The rest, they say, is history. Now, 73, a series that I remember most vividly, is the A's versus the Mets. Now, this is the series when Charlie O attempted to fire, and I use fire in quotes, second baseman Mike Andrews for making the errors in Game 2. Now, Bowie Kuhn, Hall of Famer and commissioner of the day, reinstated Mike Andrews and fined Charlie Finley. Now, talk a little bit about that series, Sal.
Well, you know, that was going to be a good series, but really early on became a distraction with everything with Mike Andrews and Charlie trying to get him taken off the active roster because he made a couple errors. And we as a team disagreed. We didn't want that to happen. And we put some armbands on our uniform for the workout in memory of Mike Andrews.
Yeah.
So we were very fortunate that Louis Kuhn reinstated him. And once we got over that distraction, we got down to baseball, we were able to win Game 6 and Game 7 and become world champions again.
Right. Now, this is good. We didn't know it at the time, but it would be Dick Williams' last time around with the club because they just had it with Charlie Finley.
Well, he told us in the clubhouse meeting, probably after we lost maybe the fourth game, that this was going to be it for him. He had had enough. And so we were aware of it, and word spread, and during the series, the media knew that he was resigning after the World Series.
Okay, now, what about that play, Sal? I guess you were at third base. You'll tell us a little bit more. Buddy Harrelson tags and attempts to score on a Felix Mian fly to left. It appears to everybody, except Augie Donatelli, the umpire, the home plate arbiter, that Buddy avoids the tag. The replays from NBC kind of show that, but he was called out by Augie, and then you have an outburst by Buddy, Willie Mays, and Yogi Berra. Do you remember that play?
Oh, I do remember, because I remember saying to Ray Fossey in the dugout, Ray, did you tag him? He gave me a smile and said, I don't think so.
That's great.
Oh, we were fortunate with that, but... you know, it was a good series, well pitched from both sides. New York had some really powerful pitchers, so it was exciting to be able to play in New York and to be able to play that series.
It was a good series. Now, how did you feel about Willie Mays in that series, Sal? He's famous for falling down, trying to get that catch that ball coming out of the sun in Oakland. It looked like Willie stayed around a little too long. The World Series confirmed it. How did the guys on the Oakland A's feel about Mays in that series?
Well, we all idolize Willie Mays, and we know what a great player he was. But you're right. He probably played a year or two too long because the true Willie Mays wasn't shown in that World Series. But, you know, he was a great player, and you can't take that away.
Definitely. To say, hey, kid, Willie Mays just celebrated his 85th birthday, by the way.
Right.
Exactly. Now, the next series we'll talk about is the third in the series of wins for Oakland. It's the A's versus the L.A. Dodgers. Now, another banner year for you guys. Catfish wins 25. Reggie knocks in 105. Billy North, as you said, in the leadoff spot, steals 54 bases. But, again, the team seems more known for the dysfunction than for the great superior lineup. Now, Hunter, as we said, was threatening to file for free agency if Charlie didn't pay him. Mike Andrews was considering legal action for the way he was treated during the World Series. Raleigh and Blue Moon get into it. Do you remember that, Sal?
Oh, yeah, I was right there.
What happened?
Well, Raleigh said something, and Blue Moon said something about Raleigh's wife or ex-wife to be.
Oh, boy.
And they got into a pushing match, and Raleigh tripped and hit the back of his head and cut it open, and he had to have stitches.
Oh, man.
And that was the workout the day before the series was to start.
Yeah. So drama right there. Despite all the off-the-field troubles, the team definitely fundamentally sound, strong pitching, speed and power, and that World Series, I believe it was 4-1.
Yeah, it was. We really had a good team. We were healthy. and the Dodgers had did a little bit of popping off in the paper about only one or two of us on the A's would make their team, and we just had to show them how good we were, and we beat them in five games. It was a well-pitched series on both sides, but we were able to get some key hits, and Raleigh had a great series as a closer and got the MVP award.
Definitely. So Oakland takes its third in a row from the Los Angeles Dodgers. Now, Sal Bando, folks, second American League third baseman to hit 200 career homers. The other one was Brooks Robinson at the time. He retired among the all-time leaders in games played. He was fifth. Assists, he was sixth. Double plays, seventh. 16-season career. 254 hitter with 242 home runs and 1,039 RBIs. Not too shabby, Sal.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the time in Milwaukee. What precipitated your move to Milwaukee?
Well, it was a first year of free agency, and you have, I think it was 13 teams draft you, or up to 13, and you can negotiate with those 13. And actually, I had some better opportunities financially with the San Francisco Giants and the Pittsburgh Pirates. But Milwaukee just seemed to be the right fit. Bud Selig was the owner. He personally came out to Oakland. We went back to Milwaukee. And quite honestly, my wife, in her opinion, she said, you don't go to Milwaukee, you're making a mistake. And she was right. And so we just went there because it just seemed like a good fit.
It was at the time, definitely, Sal, that they had a good up-and-coming ball club, and you later were general manager of Milwaukee.
Correct, and we still make it our home. We've been here since 1977 in the Milwaukee area. Being from Ohio, it's much like where I grew up. And, you know, it was the right move for us. It worked out. I was a general manager for 8 years, and I'm still very close. Bud Selig and his family.
Good old Bud Selig, yeah. Now, did you have a problem with re-signing Molitor while you were there?
Well, we didn't have a problem as much as we didn't have the money to re-sign him.
Aha, okay,
and,
yeah.
And we wanted to keep him, but the way things were moving in baseball, we were one of those small markets, and we couldn't really compete that way. And we offered him arbitration, hoping to work something out, but obviously Toronto saw how good he was and the importance he presented, and we lost out.
Who knows these guys are going to the Hall of Fame, Sal, right?
Right. I mean, you know, but you know...
Hindsight's 20-20, you know?
Right.
Now, what are you doing these days, Sal?
Well, I'm retired now, and I enjoy my sons and my grandkids and my daughter-in-laws. My wife and I, we spend about 5 months in Arizona and the rest in Wisconsin, and I'm involved in some charities, and I'm involved on the board of Bat Baseball Assistance Team, and so it keeps me busy.
Tell the folks a little bit more about Bat, the Baseball Assistance Team. I feel that's a great organization and worthy of mentioning.
Well, Bat was started years ago by Joe Gargiola and Bob Gibson and Joe Torre. And what it is we raise money through the players, and the players make their donation. And what we do is we help anybody in our baseball family that hits hard times, that needs a little help to get them over the hump, be it medical bills, insurance, food, because of a sickness, they're hurting. So anybody in the baseball family, that's players, players' wives, coaches, trainers, managers, front office people, anybody that's been in that baseball family can come to us, and we will give them an application. We have a board, and we vote on it. And believe me, we help thousands of ex-players and their families.
I bet you do, Sal. I know that baseball assistance team, otherwise known as BAT, a great feather in the cap of the late Joe Garagiola, who left us recently. And I believe you can get to the more information on BAT through the MLB.com website. Is that correct?
That's correct. And they'll tell you what we do, who's eligible, And the way we let people know is word of mouth, turning around, and we grant out a lot of money every year, and the players donate a lot of money every year.
They have it, and I'm glad they donated because that's a worthy cause. Well, Sal Bando, it's been an honor and a pleasure speaking with you tonight. I thank you for taking part out of your Mother's Day Sunday night to be with us.
Well, thank you, and good luck to you and your listeners, and we appreciate your interest. Thank you.
All the best, Sal. Sal Bando, folks. Well, up next, we'll talk to the former great closer and the 1987 World Series champion with the Minnesota Twins, Jeff Reardon. So stay with us, folks.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB. Be sure and visit us online at sportstalk1240.com.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gustbuster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit GustBuster.com and get your GustBuster today.
Want to advertise your business on Sports Talk 1240? Place an ad on SportsTalk1240.com and run a radio commercial during the show every Sunday night here on AM 1240 WGBB. Our rates are very affordable. We'll even produce the radio commercial for you. Just head over to SportsTalk1240.com and fill out the Contact Us form and let us start promoting your business today.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, New York. Bill Donahue with you. Another great sports weekend on this Mother's Day. Again, happy Mother's Day to all the moms out there. The Mets continue their West Coast swing with Mr. Harvey today defeating the San Diego Padres. The Yankees hosting the Red Sox lost 2-0. The Islanders, of course, give up the ghost in Tampa after a great season. But, of course, the highlight of the weekend in sports has to be the home run by Bartolo Colon. For anybody who saw that, a real rare piece of baseball history, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. Well, my next guest was a four-time All-Star and a World Series champ with the Minnesota Twins in 1987. He was the Rolaids Relief Man of the Year in 1985, ninth on the all-time save list with 367. We're honored to welcome in tonight Jeff Reardon.
Hey, how you doing?
All right, Jeff, how are things down in Florida?
Oh, everything's going fine down here.
Great, wonderful. It's great to have you with us. Now, you grew up in Massachusetts, and it may be a silly question, but who are your favorite teams, any favorite players that you rooted for?
Actually, my favorite team was the Red Sox, but also the Mets, because I lived pretty close to the New York state line, you know, so we would get some Met games, and Tom Seaver was my idol.
Of course.
Number 41 most of my career.
Exactly. I was going to ask you about that. Great choice. Great choice. Now, out of high school, you were drafted by the Expos in the 23rd round of the 73 draft, but you didn't sign with them. Why didn't you sign? You wanted to hang on?
Well, actually, I did want to sign, but, you know, my parents, we weren't, you know, they didn't have a lot of money, and you know, they were offering me a, you know, bonus, but it wasn't much back then. It was like $10,000, and I had a free scholarship to UMass in Amherst, and my parents wanted me to go to college because, well, I'm from a family of six, and, you know, no one went to college, so, you know, I chose that route.
Sure, yeah. You went to the University of Mass at Amherst, played your college bowl there, and then you signed a contract with the New York Mets in 77. They assigned you to Lynchburg. What a thrill it must have been to sign with the Mets.
Oh, it was a thrill because, you know, like I said, the Red Sox were my team, but the Mets were also my second team because of Seaver. And I always remember the scout, you know, I wasn't drafted out of college. And I was a free agent. They called me like one day after the draft. And he shows up at my girlfriend's house, who's still my wife of 38 years.
Okay.
And we see him driving in with Mets, you know, license plate. We're all excited. And the funny thing was he said to me, "Hey, we just traded Tom Seaver to get ready for you." So I'm thinking, well, how much of a bonus am I going to get?
Yeah.
He goes, "Well, you're going to get a plane ticket."
Okay.
You know, because I wasn't really drafted, so it was kind of funny, you know.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, and then to find out your idol's gone, not good. Now, you quickly made your way through the Mets system, though, from Lynchburg to Jackson and then to Tidewater in 79, didn't you?
Yes, I made it in like 2 years, and, you know, my first year and a half I was a starter, and I was like 27 and 5 or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the best players get invited to the Instructional League, and Joe Torre was a player manager then. And he came down to the Instructional League, and he called me into the office and said, "We want to make a relief pitcher." I was like, "Well, why?" You know, I
was expecting
him to make a league manager. "Why?" He said, "Well, we don't need starters. We want to get you the big leagues as quick as we can." And he was right, because they had Pat Zachary and Craig Swan.
Right, yeah.
They had pretty good, even though we were a last place team, you know, and I of course I had to listen to Joe Torre, and once he made me a reliever in Tidewater, I started to get a lot more on my fastballs, so I have to give a lot of credit to him.
Right, I was going to ask you about Joe Torre. You made your debut on August 25th, 79 with the Mets, and you stayed with them for a good portion of your career, mostly as you said, coming out of the pen. Could you tell Torre was going to be a Hall of Fame manager at that point, or did you have any inkling?
No, I had no idea. You know, when he managed the Mets, he finished last. And
right.
Then he went to, and then he went to Atlanta and didn't do very well there. And then I would play in a lot of celebrity tournaments, you know, at baseball tournaments, and he'd always be there. He'd have a dog.
Yeah, exactly. Till he got to the Yankees, you know, yeah.
Yeah, when he got the Yankee job, I mean, even though Joe was a great player, he wasn't a Hall of Fame player, but what he did with the Yankees put him in the Hall of Fame.
Exactly. That's what got him there, Jeff. Now, we're talking to Jeff Reardon tonight on Sports Talk 1240. How did it feel being sent to the Expos with Dan Norman for Ellis Valentine?
Well, actually, I wish I had stayed with the Mets because they always, I lived right on the line of Massachusetts, Dalton, Mass, small town, you know, maybe 40 miles from the New York state line. And, you know, I love playing for the Mets, you know, but you have no choice when you're young. I had 2 years there, and I had a great ERA and great stats. And when they traded me, that actually opened up the door, though, for me to become a closer because, you know, they had Neil Allen, who they thought would be a great closer.
Right.
You know, because he was one of the bonus babies, and I was like an undrafted guy. But, you know, I wish I'd stay with the Mets, you know, but nothing I can do. When you get traded, you get traded.
Right. Well, what folks may not realize, and the younger kids listening, is Jeff was traded to the Expos for Ellis Valentine, as we said. Ellis was damaged goods. He was hit in the face by a pitch, stepped in the bucket every time he went to swing. He really pretty good right fielder he always was with a tremendous arm. He had a rifle for an arm. But by the time the Mets got this guy, he was pretty well below the line. Right, Jeff?
Right. I agree with you because, you know, when I pitched for the Mets and, you know, we pitched against Montreal, he was like a 5-2 player.
Right.
I always tell people he had the best arm I ever saw. You know, I never saw Roberto Clemente.
Right.
But Ellis Valentine had a great arm, but, you know, the trade happened. I think when he went to New York, you know, something happened with him because, you know, wasn't a good trade for the Mets.
No.
Frank Cash, who traded me, said, you know, in his book, it was the worst trade I ever made.
Yeah.
But at the time, he was a 5-2 player.
Yeah, for at one point.
What happened at Stark, I don't know.
At one point, he was part of the big outfield with Warren Cromartie. With Andre Dawson, Tim Raines, he was a big part of that club, but taking that pitch in the face really brought him down and sort of derailed his career. And that's a great story you tell, Jeff, about Frank Cashin admitting that the trade he made sending you to the Expos was one of the worst he'd ever made.
No, I know. It was a great story when I saw he admitted it.
Right.
You know, because I think Lou Gorman was with him then, who, when I finally became a free agent in 1990, you know, I had won the World Series of Minnesota Twins, and Lou Gorman was the GM of the Red Sox, and he signed me to the Red Sox. So Lou always liked
Lou Gorman.
Sure Frank, you know, I gotta admit that Valentine was a superstar compared to me, a 2-year player.
Yeah, but sometimes the best trades are the ones you don't make, and they would have been better off sitting tight on that one. But
you
get to the Expos, they immediately turn you loose in the ninth inning to become a closer. You save 146 games from 82 to 86, and the rest, as they say, is history. You were the an all-star twice, led the majors in saves during 85, and you picked up the Rolaids Relief Man of the Year award.
Yeah, a lot of that has to do with when they hired Jim Fanning. I mean, when I first went to the Expos, it was Dick Williams.
Uh-huh.
And they had older relievers like Woody Fryman, Elias Sosa, and he wouldn't use me in that closer role. But when they fired him, Jim Fanning, you know, I think it was September, he came in the clubhouse and said, "You're going to be my closer the rest of the way." And that actually what started my great career. You know?
It sure did. You also had the opportunity, Jeff, to throw to Gary Carter, who is we all revere here in New York, and the great Hall of Fame catcher, Gary Carter. Talk to us a little bit about your experience with Gary.
Well, Gary, you know, I miss him so much. We've lived down here together for all these years. And I was so sad when he died. And I have to say, he's the only catcher that I would never shake off because he knew what to throw. You know, he was just an awesome catcher, and he had a great knowledge of the game.
He sure did. Gary Carter with the Montreal Expos, whom he started his career with. You also had the opportunity, as we said before, to play with Tim Raines and Hall of Famer Andre Dawson down there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Andre Dawson, I always told people, you know, when I played, he had the best body I ever saw in a ball player.
Yeah.
You know, and he was like my all-around player of all time that I played. And Raines, of course, he had all the ability and everything like that. You know, so it was great to play with those guys. I played with them for 6 years. And, you know, we were supposed to be the team in the 80s. And, you know, 81, we got pretty close. But Rick Monday hit that home run. And, you know, then next few years or so, we finished second all the time.
Yeah, it was tough for the Expos. They came close many, many times. Now, in 87, you're sent packing again, Jeff, this time to the Minnesota Twins. How did you feel about leaving Montreal?
Well, you know, I'd been there 6 years, so it was kind of weird, but I knew that Bob Gebhardt had just been shipped off to Minnesota, and he became the assistant GM. And Gebhardt was like with me in Montreal. So I knew it would probably be a good thing if they needed a closer. And, oh, it's the best thing that ever happened to me because we won the World Series. And I got to do my dream, pitch the seventh inning or ninth inning of the seventh game of the World Series.
Sure did. Yeah, great thrill. Now, you were the first pitcher in Major League Baseball history to have 40 save seasons in both leagues. Did you know that?
Yeah, I knew that, but I don't think a lot of Hall of Fame people know that.
No, yeah, you're exactly right. We'll talk about that, the Hall of Fame, in a little bit too, Jeff. Jeff Reardon with us tonight on Sports Talk 1240. You played in Minnesota with Puckett, Viola, and another Hall of Famer, Bert Blyleven. Talk a little bit about those guys, Jeff.
Well, a lot of people ask me about, you know, Hall of Famers, and I always tell everyone Kirby Puckett was the classiest superstar I ever played with. You know, he was so good to people, and so good to everyone, you know, all the players' children, you know, and stuff like that. And Bert was, in my mind, he should have been in the Hall of Fame a long time ago. You know, and he's a great guy, too.
Good man. And how about Sweet Music?
Frankie was a great pitcher, you know. I think, you know, when I say that seventh game of the World Series, kind of funny story. He had retired like 16 in a row. And in the eighth inning, the phone rings in the bullpen. And the bullpen coach says, Jeff, you gotta get ready. Of course we follow the game. I'm thinking, he's got 17 in a row out. and I'm just thinking, yeah, I'm warming up in case he gets in trouble. Then all of a sudden, the phone rings again, and our coach, Rich Stelmazek, says, you're in the game. And I was like, really? You know, because the first three hitters were left-handers.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, you know, I welcome the challenge, but I was like, what is Tom Kelly doing? But he went that way the whole year, and I have so much respect that he did that. Frank did not want to come out. And I had to face three left-handers, and thank God I got him on 1-2-3, or I'd have been the GOAT in that World Series.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, great story, Jeff. Now, you even had the opportunity to play for Wally Backman, or play with Wally Backman for a season in Minnesota, didn't you?
Yes, and I played with the Mets my first 2 years.
Oh, Wally was there. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Me and Wally are great friends, and I know the Mets have been doing good, and the manager is, you know, doing well. I'm hoping so much that Wally gets the job, because I always tell people he will be the future Billy Martin of baseball.
He certainly deserves a shot. If not with the Mets, somewhere. I don't know why they don't give him an opportunity somewhere, but he certainly deserves a shot. You're right, Jeff.
I pray that he gets a shot because he's a gamer all the way, you know. And I actually describe him as a Billy Martin.
Right. I agree. No, definitely. Wally deserves a shot. Now, you became a free agent after the years in Minnesota. You signed with your hometown Boston Red Sox. Now, they named the athletic field in Dalton after you. That had to be a thrill.
Oh, that was awesome.
Yeah.
I grew up in a town of only 6,000-7,000 people, and you know, when they did that, it meant so much to me. It's still there. You know, it's actually my pride and joy because, you know, being from a small town, everyone knows me there, and I love that they did that.
Beautiful, beautiful sentiment. Yeah, we've got Jeff Reardon tonight on Sports Talk 1240. How about playing with the Rocket, Roger Clemens?
Oh, Roger was, in my mind, one of the biggest gamers ever. You know, all this stuff about his steroids. I don't believe it. You
know, because I was with him from 90, 91, 92. I mean, this guy worked harder, I think, than any starting pitcher I ever saw.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, you know, I guess later they might have supposedly caught him on something, but Roger is, in my mind, you know, right up there with Nolan Ryan.
The great Clemens, definitely. Now, in Boston, you're named to your fourth and final All-Star team, another 40-save season for Jeff. You broke Raleigh Fingers' all-time save record with your 342nd. It had to be wonderful passing Raleigh Fingers, a Hall of Famer.
Oh, that was the ultimate. I mean, the ultimate is pitching, because I'm a team player, pitching the last inning of the World Series.
Right.
When I broke Raleigh's record, I was like, I can't even believe I did that, you know?
Yeah.
And it was so exciting. I mean, the fans were great, the family. And I remember when it was against the Yankees, I struck out Kevin Moss, you know, for the last out of the game. And Kevin Moss has actually hit me pretty good.
Yeah.
And Clemens came out, Bernanke, they put me on their shoulders. They wanted to carry me around the park. You know, like, rip, not like that.
Yeah.
They just bring me to my wife and kids. And then, carry me to my wife.
Yeah.
And then I leaned over and gave my wife a kiss and the ball and the kids. It was a great night.
What a great memory.
I got booed the same, and I got booed by 35,000 people.
Uh-oh.
You know, the old Fenway Baseball. You know?
Yeah. Well, they have a history of that. They even pissed off Ted Williams, Jeff.
I know.
So, yeah.
Actually, good fans are like that. They love you one night, and the next night they're gonna rip you.
Exactly. Well, the same thing would happen here, definitely. But you were traded to the Braves after the Red Sox, and you pitched in another World Series. How was it working with Smoltz and Glavine?
Oh, I knew they were great pitchers and everything. You know, so, and Steve Avery was another great one.
Right, Greg Steve Maddox, Avery, yeah.
Greg Maddox wasn't there, but, you know, Glavine and Smoltz, they were top-notch starters.
Hall of Famers for sure, definitely. Now, you're a free agent, you signed with the Reds, but you kind of knew it was over when you were in Cincinnati.
Pretty much, I think I got a bad, whatever you call it, you know, in the World Series of the Braves, you know, I pitched in a couple games and we won the first game. Second game, I gave up a 2-run homer to, I don't even remember his name, it was with Toronto.
Yeah.
And Bobby Cox kind of buried me after that, you know, even though he's a Hall of Fame manager and that. That kind of showed other teams that they didn't think I'd be a closer anymore, even though that year I had 36.
Mm-hmm.
You know, World Series is such a high profile. I think, you know, that showed other. And then I signed with Cincinnati. I shaved my beard and everything. You know?
Yeah, no facial hair. Yeah.
Yeah, that was kind of weird.
Yeah.
Then I had to kind of set up Rob Dibble, and then I ended up taking his job for a little while, you know, and then the next year I had to play with the Yankees, you know, so, you know, I don't know how to explain it, but I think the home run in game two of the World Series cost me probably four more years in the big race.
Yeah, one moment. It's something how one moment like that could cost you the rest of the career. Yeah, that's a shame, Jeff.
No, I know.
But your time with the Yankees, it looks like you came full circle. You started with the Mets, you end with the Yankees, so it had to be satisfying coming back to New York.
Oh, yeah. I you know, George Steinbrenner, you know, he gave me a chance my last year, you know, and I had shaved the beard again, 2 years in a row. But he let me have a mustache. So, you know, I was happy there for 2 months, but nobody could close out a game. And then there was a weekend against the White Sox, and I saved all 3 games. So I thought maybe I'd get my role back, but Buck Showalter, they were trying to groom the young guys. They pretty much had me there to teach them, talk to them how to do it. Bob Wickman was one of the guys, and I talked to him on the bullpen how to, you know, be a closer and all that. And I was happy that he went on to have a good career, you know?
Yeah.
But didn't help me at all.
No, but it's interesting you say, Jeff, that George seems to love the ex-Mets like Strawberry Gooden, Jeff Reardon. He likes to give people another chance.
Oh, I loved it that he gave me another chance, you know. You know, because it was, I remember my agent saying, they're not offering much money. See this or stay home. I said, I'll give it a try.
Yeah.
And I did for 2 months, but after I saw that no one really on that team, you know, was a better closer than me, I, after 2 months, I said to my wife, I'm going to retire, you know. Because I knew I wouldn't get the chance because Showalter wanted the young guys.
Yeah. That's pretty steadfast in his decisions, too, Mr. Showalter. Now, talking about the Hall of Fame, Jeff, that we broached before, it seems like since Eckersley's gone in, Raleigh Fingers is in, there seems to be a problem with putting a closer in. Lee Smith, who had the record for saves for a long time, never made it into the Hall of Fame. Of course, they'll put Mariano in when his shot comes around, but do you think he should have deserved more consideration for the Hall of Fame?
Well, I'm not a cocky guy, but, you know, I pitch in the air all those guys. And there's 4 guys in the Hall of Fame. My numbers will match up with them, you know, just as good as they have.
Uh-huh.
And I'm, you know, I'm very upset that, you know, that I never was voted in. I think it's wrong because, you know, they try to classify me as one of the guys that pitch one inning. Well, that's not true. I mean,
right.
In the 80s, I was reliever of the decade. Fingers was playing, Gossage was playing, Suter was playing, Lee Smith was playing, and I think Lee Smith should be in too.
Yeah.
So I think by me not getting in, Lee Smith will never get in, John Franco will never get in, because they're, you know, they're trying to say, well, it's the younger. Yeah, we're a little younger. But I mean, just match up our numbers, our saves, ratios,
right?
You know, stuff like that.
It's good you mentioned Franco. No. I'd left Franco out of the equation. You're right, Jeff. He deserves more consideration. Yeah.
So, and John was younger than these guys like Rivera and all, and Trevor Hoffman.
Right.
Well, we didn't pitch no one inning all the time.
Right.
I think it's very unfair that the Hall of Fame kind of kept me out, and I'm not a cocky guy at all. I just compare myself to those 4 guys, you know, stat-wise, and I'm like, you know, I say to myself, I kind of got screwed.
Right. Just check the numbers.
If I had stayed with the Mets instead of that trade, I'd be in the Hall of Fame.
You would. And it's great.
It's New York. My best years were in Montreal.
Right.
This year. So, I mean, if I had stayed in New York and I was a closer, even though Neil Allen was a closer, I think I would have made the Hall of Fame.
Great points all, Jeff. Jeff Reardon, ladies and gentlemen. Well, it's been a pleasure having you with us tonight, Jeff. I thank you for taking the time out of your Mother's Day Sunday night to be with us.
All right. Thank you, Bill.
You take care. Jeff Reardon, folks. That'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk 1240. I'd like to thank my guests, Sal Bando and Jeff Reardon. my engineer Brian Graves, and you for joining us. Stay tuned for hour number two with Eric Getzoff on Sports Talk 1240. I'll be back with you Sunday, May 22nd, with former Mets and Pirates third baseman Richie Hebner and hopefully Andre Dawson. Till then, Bill Donahue, wishing you a good evening, folks.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.